Today on Against the Grain, what can Star Trek tell us about life after capitalism? I'm Sasha Lilly. Peter Fraze joins me to talk about four possible futures in a world where workers are increasingly replaced by machines, ranging from communist and socialist societies to ones in which workers are literally disposable. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. If the brave new world predicted by futurists comes true, in which robots take most of our jobs, what political system might we end up with? Will it be one where the absence of waged work frees us, or where we face even bleaker prospects than the present? In Four Futures, Life After Capitalism, published by Verso, Peter Fraze imagines a quartet of possible societies, two based on abundance and two on scarcity. Peter, since the early days of capitalism, capitalists have tried to replace workers with machines. Also, since the early days of capitalism, there have been predictions that workers will be made permanently unemployed by machines. But on the whole, new jobs have arisen, albeit often poorly paid, to replace those rendered obsolete by machines. Why should it be different this time around?
It shouldn't necessarily. The way I would put it is that, to slightly reframe the way you've laid it out, there has been throughout the history of capitalism a struggle, a contentious question running through the development of capitalist economies, which is, as productivity increases, as new technologies are developed, as certain kinds of work are replaced by machines, is that going to lead to a future in which we have more material prosperity and also more free time for all, or simply higher profits for the few and new kinds of drudgery for the many? I think that's the same question now as it was 200 years ago, even if the particular kinds of jobs that are being automated or the particular kinds of technologies being introduced have changed.
But it seems like what you're arguing is something momentous is in the works, whether or not it is happening right now, that it points to a very different kind of future or possible futures, and you talk about multiple futures. Why do you think something of significance is taking place?
Well, I suppose partly because we're seeing a lot of energy, a lot of mental energy, a lot of anxieties, a lot of hopes also emanating both from the sphere of workers and workers' movements, but also from capitalists and, you know, people, and also, you know, mainstream economists, wondering if, well, maybe this is going to be the time when it's different and we're not necessarily going to develop some new kind of mass labor that's going to employ all of the people who will be displaced by everything from AI algorithms that parse medical records to self-driving trucks that throw out of work truck drivers, which is the biggest single category of labor in the United States. And so there is this question that's being put on the table and being addressed in different ways from across the political spectrum. In that case, if it is the case that there is some possibility, even if it's not yet a reality, if there is some possibility of very rapid mass unemployment, then what does that mean? What do we do about it? And so you have everyone from Bill Gates to, you know, people on the labor left wondering about this question and trying to put forward ideas of what we might do to address it if the old social democratic, we just need to have, you know, high wages and good unions and we can have a good welfare state. If that's not enough, then what's the answer?
Why do you assume, and this is the premise for your book, For Futures, that capitalism will end? Is there something inherent about increasing automation? Is it something else? Why is that the starting point for your imaginings here?
I mean, I suppose it's just motivated by looking at the history of human societies and human social formations to begin with, and saying that none of them have lasted forever. Some of them lasted for thousands of years, but ultimately they were displaced or they were conquered or they collapsed or they fell apart for one reason or another. And capitalism is distinguished by its speed, its dynamism, its acceleration. This is one of the things that the proponents of capitalism like to raise in its defense and to promote it, to say this is the most dynamic, it is the social form that has been able to revolutionize society more than any other. And Karl Marx, of course, said similar things about it in his writings. But that also means that it's a volatile, an unstable system. And I think we're seeing both in it internally in terms of its economics, in terms of things like the recent financial crisis and all the previous economic crises that we have seen, that is always subject to those kinds of breakdowns, depressions, bankruptcy, unemployment, all of that, and that also now increasingly we're seeing the ecological limit of this system, that a system which is premised, as capitalism is, on constant growth can, although I will say not necessarily, but can easily run up against the limit of what the planet can sustain in terms of carbon-based fossil fuels running a system based on this kind of process of constant growth. And so those are the reasons why I look at it and say, not that I'm going to predict necessarily. I don't want to predict. Part of the point of the book was to not predict, but rather to open a space of possibilities. But to say it's hard to see how you can imagine capitalism, as we understand it anyway, persisting as an eternal social system, right? Like if every other social system that we know of ultimately passed into the pages of history, of all of them, capitalism is the one that I think we can least imagine doing so, or persisting beyond. Maybe it'll last another generation, maybe it'll last several more, maybe it'll collapse tomorrow. I'm not saying that I know that, but that the system has to end.
What do you think are the limitations of predicting the future based on technology separate from considering relationships of power, as you can find in a lot of the writings about our automated future? The idea is the kind of society or societies we're going to end up will be dictated by technological change.
Well, it is a shortcoming, certainly, of many mainstream commentaries on technology and mainstream economics writing on technology, but also of certain kinds of left and socialist and Marxist writings, that they see technology as a thing that comes in from the outside, as something that's essentially exogenous to the system. So a technology appears, and then that changes society and changes history in some way. And I think it's more useful to think about it, particularly when you're talking about something like a capitalist economy, in which the key technologies relate to production and relate to technologies as they interact with human workers. It's more useful to think about technical development as something that happens in interaction with political movements and workers' movements and labor movements, so that the kinds of technologies you get and the kinds of technologies that are deployed are in many ways functions of how workers are organized and how they struggle. So that, for example, one thing that I raise is this question that is often brought up about the whole idea that we are about, the thing you brought up earlier, this whole idea that we are about to be in this robot apocalypse where all the jobs are automated and all the jobs disappear. And it has been pointed out by many critics on the left, Doug Henwood, Dean Baker, others, that this is not reflected, in fact, in the statistics on productivity, where you would expect to find, if this was actually happening, that labor, the productivity, that is, how much you can produce per unit hour of labor, should be rapidly rising as the machines become more and more able to replace human labor or to very efficiently use human labor. And you don't see that. In fact, productivity growth has been quite low in recent years, certainly compared to the 90s, compared to the post-war boom. And the way I kind of view that is, well, what's going on here, I think the most plausible story that's going on here, which you can get from me, you can get from The Economist, J.W. Mason, and other people, is that the incentive for bosses, for owners, for capitalists to economize on labor, in other words, to replace as many workers as they can with machines, is related to how cheap and how easy to control those workers are. So if your workers are weak, if your workers are cheap, if the wages are low, then why would you replace the worker with the machines? Just use the cheap worker. And so those dynamics, I think, are what drive the process forward, as well as the question of, well, there's technology and then there's technology. There's a machine that can replace a worker and therefore, at least in principle, increase our material standard of living. And then there's a machine or a program or an algorithm that serves only to increase the profit of the boss without actually making anything more efficient per se. Things like different kinds of surveillance technologies that allow bosses to monitor every microsecond of their workers' lives. It allows them to manipulate and control workers, but it doesn't necessarily increase our overall social wealth. So I think that's how I view this relationship between technology and society, rather than technology being this asteroid that just sort of comes in and hits us and that has nothing to do with our social relations.
Your starting point is that, in thinking about four different possible futures, is that they all are premised on the idea that human labor in the future will be completely replaceable by machines. And two of those futures are based on abundance, and two are based on scarcity. And so I want to start by talking about the societies based on abundance, beginning with a society based on abundance and equality, namely communism. How do you imagine such a society to look like in the future?
Well, as it's sort of this, one of the starting points of this entire book and this entire project, the short answer is Star Trek. And for any listener who has not seen it, the world of the future as portrayed in the show Star Trek is one in which they have essentially unlimited free energy based on some kind of antimatter something or other, and also completely automated production based on something called the replicator, which is essentially, if you took what our contemporary 3D printers and generalized that to the point where you can literally press a button and make anything you want, whether it's food or it's clothing or it's whatever. And so this is a world in which it is not any longer necessary to answer this question of who does what jobs to make sure that the widgets get made, and who makes what widgets, and how do we decide that, and who gets them, and so on. And the thing that I think I bring to it that you don't necessarily get either in Star Trek or in a lot of other post-scarcity speculations is the idea that this only happens, this only works, if you're able to overcome the class contradiction of the society that we live in now. In other words, just because you have that technology, even if we found the antimatter reactors and the replicators tomorrow, that doesn't mean we all then immediately go to the promised land of post-scarcity in which, you know, we can either hang around and, you know, lie in a hammock, or we can get on a spaceship and fly around the galaxy if that's our predilection. You don't get that automatically. You have to actually overthrow the property relations, the class relations, the power relations that currently rule our world, because those technologies will be in our world would be owned by somebody, would be controlled by somebody. And so the argument about communism is that this is the world of Star Trek, if you will, that we could get to, but that getting there is both a technological and a political question. And I'll just add into that, you mentioned this is the world of abundance, and abundance in my framework here means a particular thing, not just abundance in the sense of we have unlimited energy and resources to replicate things, but also abundance in the sense that we've overcome, in some sense, the ecological crisis, meaning getting to a post-carbon future, cleaning up the damage that has already been done to the planet, reconstructing our infrastructure, all of that sort of thing. So it's that is the particular thing that I'm thinking about, that we've it's imagining that we have not only overcome the need for human labor, but that we've also overcome the ecological contradiction.
Peter Fraes is my guest. We're talking about his book, Four Futures, Life After Capitalism. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So one of the questions that comes up in your imagining of a communist future is that of work and the value of work, because you are picturing a society where work, human work, has been replaced by machines. And it is a great distance from the nostalgic idea of guild labor and work, albeit crafts work, as a transcendent experience that one finds in, say, William Morris's famous imagining of a communist future, News from Nowhere, but you don't have to go to those extremes. In the Marxist tradition and outside of it, there is a lot of emphasis, or has been, on work as a value in itself, and to not be working, to imagine a society where people are not working, can be kind of unsettling.
Work has become an extremely mystified concept in late capitalism, especially, I would say, because it's often invoked as though work is the sort of end of human existence, or the way in which people realize themselves. But when people talk about work, it often runs together a bunch of different things in an incoherent way. People talk about work when they mean the things that must be done in order for a society to persist or to be reproduced, whether that's raising crops or building roads or raising children, or they are referring to whatever it is that people do that pays them a wage. So, for example, you have people on the left now that advocate the so-called job guarantee, where the government creates a job for you if a private capitalist does not, if you can't find a job in the private market. And this is sort of abstracted from the idea of what the job is or what it's content is. The idea is that there's some dignity to just doing something for pay for somebody else. And that might overlap with the first category of things that are actually what we might regard as socially necessary, although, of course, socially necessary is a politically contested category. But it doesn't have to overlap with it. And in the case of certain obvious things, I would say, like being a hedge fund trader or a prison guard or something, it certainly does not overlap with it. And then in the third category, and this is where I think the speculations about a post-capitalist future are most important, is the category of what it is that we do that gives us that sense of dignity and meaning and worth in life. And that's often conflated with either something that is socially necessary or something that is paid. But I don't think there's any reason that it has to be, and I'm suggesting that we can imagine a future in which it is completely disconnected from those things. I don't think that's totally disconnected from where we are today, in the sense that how many people are really more invested than anything else in their hobbies, in their non-waged activities, in playing the guitar or tending their backyard gardens, to just name those that are of interest to me. And so those things are work in a sense. They're work in the sense that they require some discipline and some practice and some effort, but they are not work in the sense necessarily that you get paid for them. And so I think a lot of the sort of anxiety about, well, what, you know, how can you imagine a society without work stems from this category confusion, this mystification of what work is, which is not to say, to go back to the question about automation, it's not to say that I really believe, even though it's the premise of my book, it's intentionally an exaggerated premise, I don't necessarily believe that we can actually eliminate, and in fact I say in the book, we can't actually eliminate all work whatsoever. It's almost logically impossible unless we want to live in the Matrix where the machines control us rather than the other way around. At the very least, the work of deciding what the machines do is a labor. But I do want to open the possibility of a world in which we imagine the content of our time, the content of our lives, as something other than working for someone else for a paycheck. Even if the content of that life is as simple as and as complex as simply taking care of ourselves and one another, building a more sociable and caring kind of society.
So is the crucial question here whether one gets a wage in terms of defining work, or could it be work that is productive that is unwaged? Because I could imagine people could balk at the idea of a future, let's say, utopian society, using that in the broad sense, where they would not be dependent on work for a wage, but they still have some investment in productive activity, however defined.
Yeah, well, I guess the question is, what is the reason for us to be invested in productive activity, however defined? Is it because there are certain things that need to be done? And I certainly think that is a question that arises in a lot of speculations about the transition out of capitalism, particularly when you're talking about wage and unwaged work and the work that is predominantly done by women and how the tasks are distributed, and, you know, how we answer the question of who does whatever work still needs to be done. There's a politics to that. And part of my argument is that we need to criticize wage labor and argue for ways of decommodifying it and detaching people from the need to perform wage labor precisely so that we can ask those questions about what is actually the necessary labor and who's doing it. But then there's another aspect of this, which is that people need to feel they're doing something quote-unquote productive. And I think that is actually tied to very particular constructions and often sort of masculinized constructions of what productive labor is, which are tied to wage labor, which are tied to particular kinds of labor, in a way that I think is very mystified, and that I see it as my task, as the task of critics of capitalism to try to demystify and to criticize this idea that there's some kind of security blanket of I am a productive worker that you can cling on to without having to look too deeply into what is it that really does make you a productive worker.
Well, staying for a moment more with the future of communism, one of equality and abundance, you argue that contrary to the assumptions that tend to be made about communism as an ideal society, that when we think about equality under communism, we shouldn't assume that all hierarchies disappear.
Right. I think there's a kind of stereotype about communism or egalitarian futures more generally that imagines we all wear the same gray jumpsuit and get the same gruel from the cafeteria and that's equality. Whereas my conception of it is more that we're breaking apart the master hierarchies of the society that we live in. So the metaphor that I use is that of the magnet. There's an exercise that's often done in high school or junior high school science classrooms to demonstrate the principle of the magnetic field, in which you lay a magnet down on a table and you drop a bunch of iron filings on top of it. And the filings will arrange themselves into this beautiful pattern that demonstrates the existence of this invisible magnetic field generated by the north and south poles of this magnet. And my argument is that capitalism, and particularly the capital relation between capital and labor, between those who buy labor and those who must sell labor, is sort of something with the force of a magnet in our society, which is to say it doesn't necessarily create or structure completely all the hierarchies that exist, various status hierarchies, things related to various kinds of cultural, religious, race, ethnicity, all the kind of things that come out of various aspects of our history and society. It doesn't create or define all of those things, but it draws them into its magnetic field. It aligns them with that one master hierarchy, the one that says, do you have the money, the means of production, or do you not? And the taking away the magnet doesn't take away all of the hierarchies, all of the status systems. It just takes away that one big structuring system that was drawing them all into its orbit. And so then we are in a world, not one without hierarchies, but where there's no one single hierarchy that you have to be in or out of. one that determines for, you know, one way or another, whether you have the means to live. And so I tried to explore in some ways a question that arose when I was talking about the concept of this book and the concept of many things that I've written, where I'm talking about a post-scarcity communist future, and people put to me a question that had not occurred to me. Well, wouldn't it be boring? Wouldn't there not be kind of something to live for or compete for or fight for? I thought, I'm not worried about that. I think humans are great at coming up with things to rate each other on and compete for. I just don't want to live in a world where that's a life or death question all the time, whether you're on top or on the bottom of any particular hierarchy, whether it's having the most likes on Twitter or being the best at a particular video game, you know?
Indeed. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly. Today, we're talking about the book Four Futures, Life After Capitalism. That's published by Verso, and its author is Peter Fraze. He's a member of the editorial board of Jacobin. So let's talk about the second society that you explore, the second possible future based on abundance. And this is one where hierarchy is central, along with abundance, and where the means of generating abundance are held by a small elite. Tell us more about what such a society might look like, and why do you call it rentism?
So this bit is the origin of the entire project, in fact. Because it came out of me thinking, again, about Star Trek, as I mentioned earlier, as this vision of a post-scarcity society, but looking at it with my Marxist glasses on and saying, well, the technology does not imply necessarily this particular egalitarian form of society. What would happen if our present elite of, you know, Silicon Valley overlords had their hands on the replicator and the antimatter energy and all the rest of it, and wanted to stay on top, wanted to remain a ruling class? And my answer to that was that they needed specifically intellectual property to stay on top of this. And the reason I call this particular future rentism is because the analysis of intellectual property to me turns on the concept of rent. And of course, rent in the popular sense and also in its sort of historic origins mostly refers to rent on land. You know, the fact that a landlord can extract a certain amount of money from anyone that wants to live on or farm on or build on their land. But the concept, as has been elaborated, you know, from David Ricardo to Karl Marx to David Harvey, it's a broader concept. And even some libertarians have pointed out this particular fact about rent as a particular form that arises from a particular form of property. So the distinction is that there is one form of property in which you own a physical object, and if somebody tries to take that object from you, you can call the cops and they will come and take that person away for taking the object that you own. There's another form of property in which you own not an object, but rather the form of the object, the pattern of the object, the concept of the object. So it's not that I own a pair of shoes, it's that I own the pattern to produce that pair of shoes. And that is a form of property that gives rise to rent, because unlike the physical form in which you can make money in the traditional capitalist way by, you know, having a factory where you put out some widgets and you sell the widgets and then you make the money from the widgets, instead, you now own the rights to anytime anybody downloads a copy of a certain movie, you are supposed to get a payoff. And in the world I'm imagining, where we have these replicators, except in a corporatized world, then, well, you have a replicator and it can make you a pair of shoes, but you have to put in your credit card because somebody else owns the right to the pattern that makes those shoes, even though they don't do anything to make any particular one of those copies. They just own the rights to generally any copy of those shoes that ever exists anywhere for all time. And so this gives rise to the world that I originally, before I wrote this book, called anti-Star Trek, and then I eventually came to call rentism, because it is a world based on a form of class power and a form of accumulation not based on the direct production of physical commodities, but on the rights to produce those commodities that are then licensed to others.
Well, along with rentism and communism, you imagine in For Futures two other futures, but these two, unlike the first two, are not based on abundance, but on scarcity. They are socialism and exterminism. Going with socialism for a minute, based on equality and scarcity, how does socialism differ from communism?
It differs primarily because it centers the ecological reconstruction of the world. It centers on, again, not on the management of labor, because, once again, I've presupposed that we can put that out of the picture, not to say that I think that's a total, I think that's a hyperbolic assumption, but I put it out of the picture in order to put a different thing into the picture, which is both the management of consumption and the healing and reconstruction of the earth in the wake of fossil fuel capitalism. And so here, a bunch of things are going on, and this is also the chapter that does the most things to piss people off, so I don't know how many of them we want to get into, but... One of the things is that, maybe we do need some work here. It just won't be the kind of work that we had before. It is going to be rebuilding our infrastructure, rebuilding our energy grid, all those sorts of things. There might be a role for markets here, not necessarily in the way that they work in a capitalist society, particularly because the thing about markets in a capitalist society, the problem with them is not so much that there's a market with a price mechanism. The problem is that not everybody has the same amount of money when they come to the market. So my dollar and Bill Gates' dollar don't mean the same thing to us by far. But if the question is we all have the same amount of eco-credits and we can't all just consume as much as we want, but we have to have some mechanism of deciding, well, can I have another new iPhone? Can I go on a transatlantic flight? Well, maybe a market mechanism can help us out with that. So I make that argument. And then I also get into this question of how deeply are we going to engage in intentionally altering the physical and natural world, or what's sometimes called geoengineering, which is a very controversial term, and it's associated with a lot of right-wing or capitalist ideas, but is essentially saying industrial capitalism has now put us on a path where we have irrevocably transformed the environment of the earth in ways where even if we somehow went to zero carbon emissions tomorrow, is irreversible. And so in addition to getting off of this carbon system as fast as possible, we need to think about how instead of sort of unintentionally or as a side effect transforming the climate, we are going to have to take affirmative actions to try to counteract what's been done, whether that is by something as sort of low-key as planting trees, which absorb carbon, or by having planes flying around spraying particles into the atmosphere to diminish the amount of solar energy that hits the planet. And so I kind of raise those issues as the kind of thing that a global socialist society would need to reckon with, even in the absence of the problem of the management of human labor.
In your chapter that focuses on a socialist future and these challenges of handling scarcity and the wreckage of ecological devastation, you draw from the work of Kim Stanley Robinson, the Marxist science fiction writer. And I wondered if you could talk about why you did that there. And throughout the book, you've obviously mentioned Star Trek. Why do you look to, in a work that is grounded in radical theory, why are you looking toward speculative fiction as a useful tool in thinking about these futures?
Part of it is just that I love speculative fiction, but the other reason is that I, on the one hand, I'm thinking about the future in a way that I think any radical must. Marxism itself is a kind of science fiction, I think. But there's also that line, the famous line of Marx's, that we're not to be writing recipes for the kitchens of the future.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that the future is open-ended and contingent, and that to try to predict it makes you into what I derisively call a futurist, which is to say the kind of person who writes airport bookstore books that say, here's what's going to happen in 20 years and how you can profit from it. And the problem with that is, one, the predictions never pan out.
Indeed.
But two, that it also contradicts the democratic premise of the kind of politics that I want to put forward, which is that actually the future is in the hands of the masses who will make it. So it would be logically contradictory for me to claim that I knew what that future was going to be. However, we still need ways to imagine that future. And this is where I think science fiction or speculative fiction is inherently superior to the more rigid kinds of futurism, is that it paints pictures of possible worlds, possible places we could go, without saying these are predictions. It's saying these are ways to imagine how things could be different, that are still grounded enough in our world that you can sort of see how you could get from where we are to where they are. And so you raised Kim Stanley Robinson, who I rely upon a lot in my chapter on socialism, and he wrote the Mars Trilogy, which is one of the ones I talk about a lot, which is a series of books about the terraforming of Mars. In other words, transforming Mars from its current state as a basically desiccated red planet, inhospitable to life, into a planet that people could live on. The books are called Red Mars, Blue Mars, Green Mars, talking about bringing water to Mars, bringing, you know, green plant life to Mars. And the argument that I make, and the reason that I deploy him in that particular chapter where I'm talking about things like geoengineering and the manipulation of the natural environment on Earth, is to say these are best understood or most usefully understood as kinds of metaphors, because unlike some of my more science fiction-oriented comrades on the left, I don't think we're going to Mars, or I don't think we should go to Mars anyway. I don't think that should be what we're thinking about. I think we should instead be thinking about the idea of terraforming Mars into a human habitable environment as a sort of metaphor for terraforming Earth, turning our own environment into one that we can continue to live on, given what's been done to it by the last few hundred years of human history.
In your book, Four Futures, and I should say that I'm speaking with Peter Fraze, who is a member of the editorial board of Jacobin. In Four Futures, the fourth future is the bleakest, one that combines both scarcity and hierarchy. You ominously call it exterminism. What would that society look like, and how would it be structured?
First of all, apologies to the great British Marxist E.P. Thompson, who coined the term exterminism. He was referring to the threat of nuclear war in the early 1980s, and I appropriated his term for something different, but arguably even scarier. It is the question of what happens when you break apart a great premise of the left and the workers' movement of the past few centuries. In the terms of the great left standard, solidarity forever, they have taken untold millions that they never toiled to earn, but without our brain and muscle, not a single wheel can turn. In other words, we need the bosses because we don't own the means of production. We don't have any other way to earn a living. But they need us, because who's going to run the factories? Who's going to run the shops? So what my chapter on exterminism supposes is, well, what if they don't need our brain and muscle anymore? They have robots and algorithms to do that. Then what happens? And what happens, I suggest, is that they retreat into their gated communities. They retreat to their private islands. They have drones. They have robocops to defend themselves from us. And for a while, we get warehoused, we get imprisoned, we get put in camps, we live in the parts of the earth that are getting ravaged by climate change while the rich get to retreat to their castles. But eventually, billions of superfluous people are a danger, even in the most futurist society you can imagine. And so the end logic of this is genocidal. It's exterminate these people. And as with all my other futures, the point is, to say that this is an extrapolation and it's extreme, but it's also meant to remind you and to make you think about things that exist in our world, whether it's the conflicts going on around resources throughout Central Africa, whether it's the Gaza Strip, whether it's the prison industrial complex in the United States. And so those things are all meant to make you think about what happens to people when they are simply not useful to capitalism anymore.
So could you tell us in more detailed terms what you could imagine the society that you term extremism to look like? This is one where hierarchy and scarcity are combined in a world where population has radically contracted. What do you think the contours of such a society would look like ultimately?
I think of it sort of like the fantasies that you sometimes today see coming out of Silicon Valley, especially. There was a few years back a famed or infamous speech where one of these CEOs from a tech company in Silicon Valley pretty much fantasized about seceding from society and going to live on an island or an oil rig or something because, in his mind, you know, he didn't need any of us parasites in government or any of that because it was only the heroic capitalist elite that produced anything anyway. And it's fantastic and delusional because, and many people can tell you, these people who live in San Francisco and work making crappy apps for Silicon Valley don't actually exist independent of the society that supports them. But my premise here was that what if that was true? What if they could really do it? Because clearly there are people that want to do it. And what it would look like is living on private islands, living in gated communities, and then having a lot of drones and robots to defend themselves from the people that were left out, the people that were desperate, the people that were immiserated. That was the conception of it. And that then eventually, if either, you know, eventually they're going to do something about us. They're either going to leave us to die or they're going to kill us off affirmatively if they feel the need to do so. And then either they go at each other's throats because that's the type of personality that has been produced among the small elite, or they settle into a kind of complacent existence in which they now, you know, enjoy their post-scarcity society and pretend that the genocide never happened.
I'd like to ask you about something which is not necessarily about the far future, but is debated in the present, and that is about the universal basic income. And the reason I'm bringing this up is there are people, certainly many on the left, who argue for a universal basic income that would separate people's livelihoods from their wage jobs, that people would get money whether or not they had a wage job. It comes up because in discussions of automation, there are people on the right who also talk positively about a universal basic income, and they worry that robots will end up creating an unemployed rabble. So it's a complicated question, and I wanted to know what you think of it, but related to what you mentioned not too long ago about the song Solidarity Forever and the idea that the capitalist class, we're dependent on them, but on the other hand, they're dependent on us. And is there a danger in reforms that might introduce eventually a universal basic income that might sever us as workers from our traditional position and make the capitalist class less dependent on us?
I will say, first of all, just to toot my own horn a little bit, I gave a talk about this at the University of Leeds a month or so ago, which you can find a video of online, about the precisely the politics of basic income that you're referring to, that there is a right and a left version of it. This is a fairly new phenomenon in terms of mainstream discourse or even semi-mainstream discourse. When I first started thinking about basic income 10 or more years ago, it was a fringe idea on the left and the right and rarely talked about. Now it's kind of got a little bit of cachet. And you're right, there's a right-wing and a left-wing version of it. And I'm not so much concerned about what you raised, this idea that it furthers the disconnect between work, the kind of dependent, the mutual interdependence of capital and labor, because in some ways, I think just about every victory of the working class has that effect in a certain way. It's just another version of what's sometimes called the decommodification of labor. In other words, lessening that degree to which the only way you can survive is to find someone who will hire you and pay you a wage. Universal health care is decommodifying in basically the same way. If you get your health care as of right from the state rather than from your employer, then that lessens that mutual interdependence. I nevertheless think it's a reform worth fighting for. I do think it's important to put basic income in its proper context, which is that it's a useful replacement for certain kinds of paternalistic and controlling kinds of state programs, food stamps and other cash transfers that you have to apply for and meet with caseworkers and jump through various hoops. These kinds of programs that are subject to what I would call maybe a Foucauldian critique of the welfare state that says that to the extent that you can just give people checks unrestricted rather than making them have to fill all these detailed restrictions, then that is in sort of an increase in freedom. But what we have to be cautious about is the right-wing or the capitalist versions of basic income that say we can just blow up the whole welfare state and replace it with passing out checks. It doesn't work for a bunch of reasons, one of which is just that the size of the check's not going to make up for the amount of the budget they want to cut, and the other one being that there are certain things like health care, for example, where giving everyone an equal amount of money to buy health care is not, in fact, egalitarian because we don't all need the same amount of health care. Some people are bearing children. Some people are not. Some people have cancer. Some people do not. So that's just like from a principled, moral, left egalitarian perspective is a non-starter for me. But that doesn't mean that basic income as a part of a larger package of demands shouldn't be part of our argument, partly because I think it does have both a functional and a rhetorical value as saying we live in a rich society and we just all deserve some minimal level of living.
In thinking about four different possible futures, if we end up with one of these futures, will that be the end of the story? Could the future hold more than one?
More than one, all of them, or one leading into the other? I tried to add a little plot twist. I guess, spoiler alert, I'm going to tell you what I do at the end of the book. Where I suggest that these are not necessarily neat morality plays. You can imagine the communist future that we began with, this world where everybody is just chilling, they got their replicators, they're just like running Disneyland for fun, which happens in a Cory Doctorow novel that I use in that chapter as one of the illustrations. Everything's great, right? Well, how did we get here? And one explanation of how we got here is that there used to be a lot more people on Earth, but we went through the exterminist period in which they all were left to die of, you know, preventable diseases or were actively killed off through various kinds of militaristic and carceral strategies. And then, once all the extra people were dead, we were living in the communist utopia. And, of course, this is another feature of our present that we don't like to think about the histories that led up to the society that we live in, certainly as an American, the histories of colonization and genocide. And so that's sort of the last turn of the screw that I want to make. Not only are all the futures here, not only is it the case in the William Gibson quote that I love that the future is here, it's just unequally distributed, it is also the case that there are very complicated, morally complicated, snaking paths between the different futures that I'm talking about, interactions between the futures that I'm talking about that don't just fall into these are the good ones, these are the bad ones.
How do you think how we imagine the future or don't imagine the future, how does it affect radical politics today? I mean, you mentioned earlier that you would warn us away from mapping out blueprints for the future, that we need to recognize the need for people to shape their own future as they're making it. But at the same time, there's a kind of thick fog of despair that hangs over a lot of our societies and a lot of the left about the future. It's hard to imagine a future that's not going to be worse than the present. How do you think, in picturing these futures, which are starkly different from each other, is there a political value in thinking about the future and stretching our minds around the different possibilities?
I think there is, and I think the key question is to imagine a future. In my more mundane local political work, one of the questions I like to ask when we're having meetings of my socialist organization is to have everyone go around, introduce themselves, and say, you know, who they are. And then the question is, what do you do after the revolution? Meaning, you don't have to go to a job you probably don't like, and you don't have to show up at socialist meetings. What do you want to do? And that's an entry point to thinking about what the whole point of our politics is, that's actually about positively what we want rather than negatively what we don't want. And to take that then to a more abstract or more conceptual level, I've been influenced by some of the work you yourself have done about catastrophism and the problem that arise when you have a left that is rooted in simply talking about how bad everything is and how ruined everything is and how screwed we all are, which, no matter how true it is on some level, ends up functioning as an alibi for inaction. It ends up functioning as a way for people to say, well, it's all done, it's all over, what's the point? And I think it's a very kind of narcissistic and self-serving thing compared to saying, well, no, it's not all over, and if I take action, I might screw up and I might do it wrong, but that's my actual moral responsibility.
Peter, thank you so much for joining me.
It's been a pleasure, Sasha. Thanks for having me on.
I've been speaking this hour with Peter Fraes. He is the author of Four Futures, Life After Capitalism. That's published by Verso, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. He's a member of the editorial board at Jacobin Magazine. And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.